Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Marianne Russo. I'd like to start off by thanking my sponsor for today's show, Mayor Johnson. With every child, there is a solution. Explore a variety of educational solutions at mayorjohnson.com. And you can save 20% by using their promo code Solution 20 at checkout. Mayor Johnson is the world's super source for special education and board maker resources. So go over and take a look. This is a really special interview for all of you suffering with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, but it's particularly important for me. And for those of you that listen to my show or read my blogs, you often hear me refer to the amygdala. And, you know, I'm sure you're quite frankly sick of hearing me discuss the chain of events in the limbic system, you know, stemming from the amygdala as it pertains to mental illness and anxiety disorders in children. And I mention it frequently because it's key to understanding your child. And I got this education I quite frankly never wanted in an effort to understand my middle daughter, who was had PANDAS and developed an anxiety and panic disorder 14 years ago. And it really almost foreshadowed the story that would unfold in my life. You know, my education about the amygdala took a surprising and really emotionally painful turn when my youngest daughter was struck with a very severe form of juvenile fibromyalgia 3 years ago. And, you know, I say surprising because it turns out that the amygdala could be at the root of not only one of my child's disorders, but in my child's with fibromyalgia as well. So Ashok Gupta has spent his life's work trying to unravel the mystery of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. He is the head of the Chronic Fatigue Syndrome and Fibromyalgia Clinic in London. And he has a really unique perspective on these disorders because he himself was a sufferer of chronic fatigue. And what he's learned about their possible causes, the effect on, I mean, so many things, the immune system, the pain loop, the fatigue, the sensory stimulation, the gastro issues, muscle pain. I mean, we're going to go through it all. But, you know, he will give you a key to not only understanding, but possibly reversing these syndromes. And I just want to say before I bring him on the air that we are not saying here today that chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia are psychological disorders. They are not. They are real physical conditions with physical symptoms. And what we are going to discuss is the possibility that they are rooted in the dysfunction of brain messages, primarily from the amygdala. And, you know, that's why these people have become so debilitated. And we are not in any way diminishing what you're going through, believe me. So it's an honor to bring on Ashok Gupta. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's great to be here, Marianne. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, I'm just so excited that you're here. You know, we have a lot to go over, so I'm going to try to move, you know, fairly quickly because these are really very complex disorders. You know, as I mentioned, you yourself were a sufferer with chronic fatigue. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. So I suffered from the condition for about 3 years whilst I was at university. And for me, the experience was obviously very debilitating. And the only way I can describe it, it's like the worst day of flu that you've ever had times 100. So it kind of mimics, you know, a lot of those symptoms of very, very severe flu. But, you know, your body's just so exhausted. You mentally can't think. I couldn't even pick up a book. And luckily, I was never bedbound. So I was never at the stage where I couldn't actually physically get out of bed. But apart from that, I had all the symptoms, you know, the classic symptoms of CFS. And from time to time, I also had pain in the joints, pain in the limbs and the muscles as well, although pain wasn't there throughout my experience of the condition. And it took me, you know, quite a long time to really research the condition, as a lot of people do. And I eventually found out a lot about the brain neurology of emotion, the brain neurology of stress, the brain neurology of pain, and also the brain neurology related to, you know, stress-related conditions. And I put lots of the jigsaw pieces together until I came up with a hypothesis that made sense to me and then had that published. So that was really my journey from having the condition, not knowing anything about it. It really was like a brick wall in front of me where I couldn't move forward, right through to getting myself 100% better and then looking to help other people with this.
And that you're doing. You know, it's my understanding, I know you just mentioned the muscle ache and the joint pain. You know, my understanding has always been that although, you know, these do accompany chronic fatigue, The chronic fatigue is more marked by fatigue, and an overall, like you said, feeling of you know, poor feeling of well-being, like you had the flu. Where fibromyalgia, excuse me, is more accompanied by pain.
Yes.
So can you tell us the difference between the two and why they're so often found together?
Yes, well, I've heard them referred to as the evil twin sisters. And
true.
So, you know, they share a lot of characteristics. And interestingly, your diagnosis will be based on which country you're in. So there are certain countries where CFS is diagnosed, or ME, as it's sometimes known in Europe, is diagnosed far more often than fibromyalgia, whereas in places like, for instance, Germany, fibromyalgia is the most common diagnosis. So I think there's a huge crossover between these conditions. And obviously with CFS, as you say, there's more of the kind of immune type symptoms. With fibro, there's more of the pain symptoms. But I see these, I see all of these conditions as a scale of illnesses. So multiple chemical sensitivities, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME. They are all a range of different conditions which all have one common component, which is overstimulation of the central nervous system. And the cluster of symptoms that each patient experiences will be different according to their own genetic, psychological, and physical vulnerabilities.
And you know, so, a lot of people use them interchangeably.
Yes, exactly. So a lot of people will refer to CFS and fibro in the same breath. As I said, I do think that they are different conditions in the sense of the cluster of symptoms, but actually there's an underlying common cause to them. And I find that CFS is often contracted after a kind of flu virus or some kind of unknown stomach bug, etc. Mm-hmm. Fibromyalgia often comes after some kind of physical injury or accident or a chronic pain syndrome which has suddenly got much worse.
Right.
And chemical sensitivities tend to come from when someone is stressed and they've had exposure to some kind of toxin.
Right.
And so sometimes the triggering event or the triggering situation can also have an influence on whether it develops as CFS or fibromyalgia.
Well, that's really interesting because in my daughter's case, it started with a head injury and a concussion. And, you know, a year later, over the course of that first year, she became allergic to everything. I mean, she can't even take antibiotics. She would wind up in anaphylactic shock. But, you know, let's talk about some of these triggers because, you know, they really do vary. And it can, you know, become... Some people feel that it's from a period of severe emotional stress. Mm-hmm. Some feel that it's from a physical trauma. Can you tell us how these triggers play a role? You know, how could someone that has a physical injury then develop this pain loop?
Okay, well, the brain neurology of this is absolutely fascinating. And I'm going to try and just create a very simple model for everybody to get this. Essentially, imagine there's two components to this. There is often acute stress, so emotional stress, it might be mental stress in terms of working very hard at work, combined with a physical trauma or a physical trigger. And as I said, in fibromyalgia, it's often some kind of physical injury. CFS, it's you know, some kind of virus or bacterial infection, and MCS is a chemical trigger. Now, what happens is, because the nervous system is already overstimulated, so the stress system is already overstimulated, that brain structure that we're going to talk about, the amygdala, is on high alert. And so when the physical injury comes, that part of the brain inappropriately starts reacting to the symptoms from that injury. Right? It's like a very sensitive part of the brain that's looking for something else to react to because it's on emotional high alert. So it then begins to react to the physical symptoms from the body. And once that trauma has occurred in the amygdala, and when I say amygdala, it also involves many other brain structures, such as the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland, and the insula. There's many different structures involved, but the amygdala is the part of the brain that really makes that final decision as to what to react to. In that highly emotional state, it then starts reacting to a physical aspect of from the body. And this is the really interesting point that I want everyone to really think about and reflect on. The amygdala does not differentiate between emotional triggers, physical triggers, immune triggers, etc. as far as the amygdala is concerned, if you are in danger, it will have to come up with a reaction to protect you. So if a wild tiger is running towards you, the amygdala has to make sure that you can run away from it. If you are suffering from a virus or a bacterial infection, the amygdala has to make sure that you avoid the situations that might bring that on, or that if the body is in that state, how to best help the body cope with that. And there is some recent research showing that certainly in chemical sensitivities, the amygdala's responses are involved in allergies and sensitivities and things like that. If the external stimulus is a pain, then the amygdala will get triggered. And, you know, we have anxiety responses when we experience pain, because it's got to decide how you can better solve that pain in your body and get away from anything that's causing you that pain. So the brain is constantly deciding how to protect you from danger. It's our evolutionary response. The issue arises when that part of the brain overreacts and overprotects and gets stuck in its own loop. That's what this condition is. It's an evolutionary protective impulse that has become over-triggered and got caught in a vicious cycle in the brain.
You know, and I'm so glad that you're coming on to discuss this because, you know, as I said, I've been researching the amygdala, it seems like forever. And, you know, in going to literally the best in the world to try to find out about my daughter with the fibromyalgia, they kept referring to the pain loop. And, you know, I didn't realize how lost that was on me until I found you, because the amygdala really is what controls the pain loop.
Yes, imagine the amygdala is like it's like the thing that adds fuel to the fire. So if there's a fire burning, the amygdala is the part of the brain that will decide whether more fuel needs to be added as a reaction. And so there are other parts of the brain. There's lots of parts of the brain that are involved in pain sensitivity, pain reaction, etc. But it's the amygdala that decides how much the volume is turned up on that reaction. So that's probably a better analogy. You know, how do we turn the volume up on this reaction? And so a lot of people in fibromyalgia discuss this idea that the pain signals are definitely there and it's a real physical illness. But what makes it even worse for the patients is that the amygdala is turning up the volume of those signals so that the experience for someone is incredibly severe.
Right. It's the most intense pain anyone could ever imagine.
Exactly.
You know, which is what I think people also that don't have fibromyalgia or love someone with fibromyalgia don't really understand. And it is really physical because, you know, like in my daughter's case, I was telling you before we went on the air, when she's in a flare, it actually looks like she has, you know, half-cut golf balls all over her back from the muscle spasms.
Right.
So, you know, this is a really real, really painful disorder. And, you know, I want to move on to the genetic predisposition, because I know that Dr. Enlander is going to be doing some genetic studies. But does this tend to run in families?
You see, it's very difficult to decipher whether there is how much of it is a genetic predisposition and how much of it is it related to the anxiety levels that someone inherits through nurture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me explain this because I want people to be very clear on this. There is definitely a genetic predisposition. There is definitely some kind of link, but I don't think it's as strong as, you know, it's not obviously a purely genetic condition. I don't think the genetic connection is as strong. But what they do have evidence of is that certainly the level of anxiety of the amygdala can be related to the mother's level of anxiety. And that can be related to during pregnancy, how anxious the mother is during pregnancy, and also during those first 5 to 10 years of nurture, how much the amygdala is stimulated, what the factory setting of the amygdala is and how much it reacts as you grow up. And so that can then give people a higher predisposition to having the condition through those two mechanisms. So one is the nature, the genetic predisposition, and one is the nurture, how much higher stimulation of the amygdala is being passed on through nurture.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I see that a lot of the parents I speak to and a lot of the adults that I speak to, their anxiety tend to run in the family. I mean, I know that I have, you know, a lot of anxiety and disorders in my family. So I could see how, you know, that could affect it as well. And, you know, stress is really key in this. You know, and we discussed before about how you could have a physical trauma that could really set off this chain of events. And, you know, I was also told that, you know, sometimes people have what they think is a minor car accident, but, you know, a year later wind up with, you know, fibromyalgia. But, you know, stress is universal for people with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. So, you know, I always sort of was trying to unravel, you know, the question of the earth, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the stress of the injury or a life event cause the disorder, or does the disorder cause the stress?
Combination of both. That's always the simple but complex answer. So essentially, initially, the predisposition is someone that is prone to stress. Their amygdala is more sensitive, as it were. Then an injury, a life event comes along which increases the stress, and then the injury comes along which increases the stress even further. And because those have now increased, the body is now overstimulated. And because the body is overstimulated, the resources are being used up of the body very quickly. And then you get secondary complications in the body, pain magnification, etc. And those symptoms loop back to the brain, which is already in a highly stressed state, and then the brain thinks, oh no, you've got to be kidding me, we've got even more pain and negativity to deal with, I need to overstimulate the body and the brain to alert us to the danger that's happening here, and then it overstimulates. So that's how you get caught in that loop, the chicken and egg. They both feed on each other. But initially, the predisposing factor, I believe, is a sensitized amygdala. So if there was an egg, that would be the first egg. And in terms of why is that amygdala highly sensitized, more and more research is showing that the inhibitory mechanism, so the mechanism in the brain that stops the amygdala getting out of hand, that part of the brain, for some reason, becomes weakened in people who get this condition. So it may initially be weak, but then as they get the condition, it becomes weaker and weaker. And the theory is that when the brain is overreacting and sending out stress hormones and neurotransmitters, that inhibitory mechanism, the very mechanism designed to calm that reaction down, may get damaged or may not function correctly. And that's why the amygdala gets out of hand.
Well, we're going to discuss later in the interview, you know, how you break the vicious cycle, because that's really what your program is all about. But I want to talk about the viral connection, because there is a very strong viral connection, like you said, especially to chronic fatigue. And, you know, many viruses are thought to be possible triggers, mononucleosis, Coxsackie, which I think a lot of people don't know, very common childhood disorder. You know, there are a lot of different viruses. And, you know, I think there are some questions about how the immune system becomes so dysregulated in these people. And, you know, I have personal confusion, and I know a lot of other people do, about blood testing, because, you know, you go in and they take really, you know, massive amounts of blood to run all of these tests, and, you know, you'll come up with astronomical, you know, as my daughter did, astronomical counts on her titers. Now, to me, that would... Initially, it signaled that, well, that must mean that her immune system was doing the right thing because she developed all these titers to fight the infection, but I understand that's not how it works. So how does your body respond to these viruses, and what do these tests show?
Okay, well, it's a very interesting picture, and it's very confusing, because traditionally we might think that the immune system is either on or it's off, and if it's on, why isn't it clearing all these various dormant viruses in the body? The way to look at the immune system is that the immune system only functions correctly if it is responding appropriately to the situation. Let me give the analogy of some soldiers guarding a castle. So the soldiers are guarding the castle, and there is a north entrance and there is a south entrance to the castle. Now, the soldiers have just fought off an attack on the south gate of the castle. But they've sustained a lot of damage there, and they've just, you know, they've only just managed to fight off the virus. So they're pretty on guard in case another attack comes in on the South Gate. Now, what's actually happened is that the South Gate, there aren't going to be any further attacks on the South Gate. But because those soldiers have become traumatized, because they're so scared that another attack might come because they nearly got defeated last time, because they were so stressed out, they keep guarding the South Gate, and they keep responding and sending out search teams on the South Gate. And so that the immune system is over-responding on the South Gate. But that means that soldiers attacking viruses that are coming to the North Gate, they can get through quicker and cause havoc because the immune system is over-responding to a threat that has already passed. And so I'm sure many of us have heard of those stories of, in the Vietnam War, at the end of the war, there were soldiers stuck in the middle of the jungle who actually didn't know that the war had ended. And when they were told, look, the war has ended, there's no need to fight, they didn't believe the people because they were so traumatized by the war, and their focus was to defeat the enemy. And yet the war had ended for like a year or 2 years. And so in the same way, there are parts of the immune system that become so heavily conditioned to fight off the virus or the bacteria or the issue that opportunistic viruses tend to then flourish in the body.
That's a great analogy.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, yeah, to me it makes sense. You know what, and it leads me, you know, it begs the question then, would antivirals or immunomodulators be helpful in this case? And maybe that makes sense why when you would start an initial treatment like that, the die-off effect really can be quite brutal.
Exactly. So, I've had some patients who have had some benefit on antivirals, but what I believe is the antivirals aren't necessarily getting to the root cause. If someone takes antivirals and that clears up their condition and they're completely better, then clearly the symptoms were purely coming from those opportunistic viruses, and they didn't necessarily have the underlying fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome. I believe that when you're taking these antivirals, they are, they may well help reduce those viral titers, and they may improve symptoms to a certain extent. But I believe that when you get to the root cause of why the body itself is not eliminating these viruses, when you reset the nervous system and you reset the immune system, then the body itself has the power to deal with these opportunistic viruses. And many of us don't realize that actually, a lot of these drugs that we take, they are not necessarily doing what the body should have done. They're just helping the body do what it needs to do. So I think, if people find that antivirals are useful, then I'm not against them. But I don't think they necessarily get to the root cause of what's causing the condition.
Yeah, I mean, it's so variable for so many people. And I wasn't going to go into this. I was going to jump right into exhaustion, but it seems to be a good segue for this. I know that we've tried a lot of vitamin therapy with my daughter, and we have initial great results. And then over a few weeks, they seem to lose their effect. And a lot of people tell me the same thing with diet. We never had any success with diet. But what role do vitamin supplementation and diet play?
They do play a part. So when the nervous system is overstimulated, when you're in this chronic sympathetic state, as it's known, the resources of the body are being used up, so the vitamins are being used up, etc. And so when you do replace the vitamins, make sure you're eating a healthy diet. So, I'm a big fan of having the vitamins naturally from diet, but obviously taking supplements where required. A person may notice an initial improvement, but once again, it's not getting to the root cause of what the issue is. It's just helping the body deal with the symptoms. And when someone does have a relapse or something like that, then the vitamins won't necessarily be dealing with that, which is why the symptoms will come back.
Yeah.
And there is also another effect. So when we start on a new therapy or a new treatment, initially there is that sense of positive anticipation that I will get something out of this, that something positive will come from this. And studies show that when someone gets into that state, temporarily, the signals from the amygdala can be dampened and have not such an effect. and therefore the vicious cycle can begin to slow down. But once they've used that therapy, they've noticed improvement, there can be a virtuous circle. But once the amygdala gets overstimulated for some other reason, such as external stress, or the pain gets worse for no reason, then the vicious cycles can come back, and then the person loses that positive anticipation that that particular treatment is going to work for them, and then they get back into the state that they were before. And I have so many people who've told me that, whether it be acupuncture, diet, supplements, etc., they've tried a therapy, it's worked for a little while, and they felt much better, but then they've gone back to their normal state. And I believe the only logical explanation for this is a temporary slowdown in the neurological pathways of the brain due to the positive anticipation of improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you're saying is pretty much what we're living. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the acupuncture. You know, when my daughter, her first pain, which now they're referring to as a fibro pain, but who knows, she had excruciating ear pain for 8 months. Five right. ENTs, nobody could find out where this pain was coming from. And finally, we had an acupuncturist that got her out of the really severe pain. It still lingers. But the thing was, you know, she was able to get her out of the pain, but as she continued, it actually started worsening.
Yes.
And we discontinued that. And the same thing with magnesium. I mean, we're going to move on to exhaustion. Exhaustion is huge. I mean, sleep was pretty much non-existent for a year and a half. And magnesium for a while helped with sleep. But the exhaustion is absolutely debilitating, mostly more for the chronic fatigue than the fibro, but from the pain of the fibro, they can't sleep. So, and post-exercise malaise is also universal. What is happening in the body to cause such exhaustion? And, you know, there's always the question, does exercise help or hurt?
Okay, so let's deal with the exhaustion first. Now, imagine that this nervous system reaction that is sometimes called the sympathetic nervous system reaction, although it's not very sympathetic, unfortunately.
No, not at all.
It's the wrong tag for it, really. When you overstimulate the body, that is designed to occur for a few minutes at a time when you're in danger. So let's say your boss shouts at you at work and tells you off for not performing correctly. You'll have a sympathetic response which might last a few minutes, or if you're unlucky, maybe half an hour as you get stressed about it. But gradually that response should calm down and you should go back to normal. Now, in this condition, it's unremitting and it's continuous. So you're constantly stimulating the central nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. That is massively depleting all the reserves in the glands of various neurotransmitters and hormones. It's using up all the actual energy that we typically think of energy as in, you know, the energy that the mitochondria produce in the cells. It's using up all that energy. And the mental energy, it's using up in terms of overstimulating the brain circuitry and using up the energy there. So, you know, energy is quite an amorphous concept, but really we're talking about physical energy, mental energy, emotional energy, and to some extent spiritual energy as well, all gets very depleted. And so you can have that complete feeling of exhaustion because of that overstimulation. And the interesting thing is, a lot of patients report that they feel completely exhausted, but their brain can sometimes still feel very wired.
Right.
They can feel like they just can't relax their minds, and their minds are constantly feeling busy. And that is a clue to the fact that the brain and the amygdala are overstimulating and causing that exhaustion. Because if it was just general exhaustion, then you would also have that feeling of just, you know, not being able to think either. And most patients report that they tend to have the yo-yo between having a wired feeling where their mind feels very busy to then a feeling in the head that they just can't even think about anything because they feel so weak mentally and emotionally, obviously as well as physically. And so that exhaustion is down to that overstimulation. And to give you a clue of this, but only, you know, only 1% of exhaustion. If you take somebody who has worked really hard all day in an office, in a stressful environment, and they've been sitting behind a desk, they haven't done any physical activity, but they've got really stressed all day. And I'm sure we've all had the experience, you know, of coming home and sitting in front of the sofa and feeling absolutely exhausted, even though we've done no physical activity. Now, that exhaustion is just 1% of the exhaustion that you have in fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. But it gives us a clue. It is because the nervous system is overstimulated, that has caused the exhaustion. And in post-exercise malaise, what's happening there is that the body, because it's used up all the resources from the overstimulation, exercise requires more resources, but the body just doesn't have those resources to give. And so when you do, if you do over-exercise and push yourself too hard, there are further complications that occur. And, you know, there are some researchers that have some very complex ideas as to how that post-exercise malaise seems to happen the next day or the day after. I believe there's actually potentially damage to the muscles if you exercise when you physically are so drained, because the muscles are not getting enough resources. And so when you push your muscles too hard, even though they're feeling weak, I do believe there's actual physical damage. And that physical damage only causes the pain. You know, they often find there's a delay of a day or two as the repair kicks in. So once the body tries to repair the muscles, that's when you get the pain 1 or 2 days later.
And you know what? I want to just go with 2 points that you said there. You know, I think what's really frustrating for these people also is because they do have that busy mind. I mean, we call it overthinking. But you combine that with the brain fog, and then the inability to, your mind wants you to get things done, you want to function, and your body says no, and then your brain fog, it's just so overwhelming, you know, mentally to deal with this. But you know what I want to talk about with the exercise and why I asked you this is because, you know, I've, like I said, been on a journey with this. And we saw, you know, one of the top palliative pediatric care specialists in the country not too long ago. And are you aware that what some people are recommending now are these boot camps, which I think are absolutely off the wall? That's my personal opinion. Right. But where you go to these places and you're there for like 6 weeks and they get you up at 8 a.m. and you do hard pounding aerobics and you do this for weeks. And they say, you know, they say that that's what breaks the cycle in the brain. And obviously I'm talking to you, so you know, we're not entertaining that. But it just seems to me that when a body is you know, so run down, that something like that, how could that really change the amygdala and change the messages from the brain?
Yes, I mean, it's you know, it may well work for a very small percentage of the people there. I mean, I'd be interested to see what results they think they're getting. But for most people, it will cause longer-term damage to do something like that. So you have to pace the body and listen to what the body is actually telling you with these symptoms. And exercise has its role to play. I call it activity. You know, certainly there has to be some level of activity, but it can't be at a point where you're just pushing your body to do more than it's physically able to do. And that's just a recipe for disaster. And there's something else I just wanted to add in terms of sleep as well. The key to this condition is actually getting the sleep rhythms corrected. That's right. One of the keys, at least. Mm-hmm. And the reason that the sleep is so key is because that deep sleep that we get is when the body really repairs and heals itself and replenishes itself. Now, what they find is that in studies, if people have a disrupted sleep, it's often because the amygdala is still active at night. And because the amygdala is active at night, the body does not go into those deep delta wave rhythms of sleep where that repair occurs. And in CFS, fibro, it's the same issue. The brain is not getting into those deeper repairing states at night. And therefore, the person wakes up in the morning and feels completely exhausted. And, you know, so there are so many clues that point to the amygdala, because most sleep studies show that it's the amygdala which is still alert at night when they, you know, when they put sleeping people in these brain scanners. Mm-hmm. And so it is only when you retrain the amygdala, when you're able to calm it down, even at night, then you get more of that deep restorative sleep, and then the symptoms improve the next day. And studies also show that people who don't have fibro but have, you know, days or weeks of disrupted sleep often wake up with pain in their body. So pain and sleep are inevitably linked here.
You know, and I know that, you know, we've resolved my daughter's sleep issues, and, you know, in some respects it has helped her. You know, it hasn't been the answer to everything, but she's functioning much better. But, you know, so many people that I speak to and you know, other parents that have this, because it's not as rare as people think for children, that the sleeping is the problem, is that they're up until 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't get a restful sleep, and then they're sleeping until noon. So how does someone break that cycle? Because I agree with you. I think that breaking the problem with sleep is really key to even getting this whole process started.
Well, the key is that the brain has to calm down in the waking state. So when the brain is calmer in the waking state, it'll ease into a deep sleep state much easier at night. So, for instance, some people do find, and I recommend this to all my patients, that in those last 2 hours before you go to sleep, it's best to avoid anything stimulating, whether that be, you know, TV or stimulating foods or sugar or caffeine or anything like that, but instead focusing on something that relaxes your nervous system. So that might be a meditation, or that might be a hot bath, or that might be actually laughing. So laughing is known to be one of the most powerful ways of stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system. And so I encourage my patients to buy their favorite comedies, put them on at night, and laugh out loud until they just feel like something is just calmed down or released from their body. So whatever someone has to do to calm the bodies down before they go to sleep, it can be useful. Now, that doesn't mean that will solve the sleeping issues, but it at least will improve the situation.
It's funny you say that, because my daughter used to love these murder mysteries. And, you know, one of the docs said, well, don't let her watch that at night. You know, watch something funny. And we've started watching, like, Big Bang Theory and Modern Family every night. And, you know, I think it really does make a difference. But
I love Big Bang Theory, and I have been accused sometimes of being a Sheldon. So
there you go. Who doesn't love Sheldon? you know, but it really is. I mean, the key is so difficult. And, you know, medications, and, you know, too. I mean, I know that, you know, medications sometimes help with sleep, not so much sleep aids. But, you know, as we're going to go into now, the antidepressants that, you know, they found really quite accidentally that, you know, they were treating these people with fibromyalgia pain, you know, that developed, you know, severe depression and anxiety, and let's face it, who wouldn't, and how it helped the pain. So you know, calming your like you said, your mind and your amygdala during the day does flow over into the night. You know, and talking about medicine, just, you know, to bring this up, you know, why don't narcotics work? I mean, my daughter's been in the intensive care unit. That's how severe, you know, hers is. And, I mean, you know, they tried morphine. They tried everything. Nothing put a dent in the pain. So why is it that narcotics, for most, I'm not going to generalize, for most people really aren't the answer and actually do more harm to the heart and other organs?
It's a temporary sticking plaster to the problem. And so when you take a drug initially, first of all, the body is getting used to the drug. So people in this state, their bodies are sensitive. So you're sensitive to any new emotional trigger, physical trigger, chemicals trigger. So that's the first issue. Even if your body then does accept the new drug, it may work temporarily, but then the brain and the body compensate for those narcotics. And there is always, I'm not going to say always, there is often a addictive quality to a lot of these drugs. So we spend a lot of our time at the clinic actually helping people come off these drugs, because when you try to come off them, often the symptoms are worse than you ever had before you started taking them.
I would imagine,
So I'm not saying that people shouldn't take them. I'm
right.
Just saying that they are sticking plasters to the problem, and the body will compensate. So if you are, you know, taking SSRIs, if you're taking antidepressants, over time, the brain will compensate for that. So then when you start coming off the antidepressants, you may actually start feeling anxiety and start feeling a lot worse than you ever did before. And so my suggestion to people is always, you know, if something so extreme that you have to take the drug, that's fine. But I would focus on things which are natural ways of calming the mind and brain down, which will have a longer-term effect and help people.
Right. And, you know, I'm not – listen – if there's somebody out there that's finding some relief, I mean, God bless. I mean, I wish I had found something for my daughter. You know, and I can understand where, you know, if you find something to relieve the pain, that, you know, you're going to try it. But, you know, I also know that, you know, what you're saying is true. It's really, you know, it's not the end all to it. You know, and then on top of it, you know, with all of this happening, I mean, your mind, you know, the pain, the exhaustion, you know, a lot of people wind up with, we'll go into two topics. The sensory issues come into play. There's an over-stimulation, really, of the senses, and it's like, misfiring. And a lot of people become oversensitive to sound, light, touch, textures, and it causes agitation. So how does the amygdala play a role in these sensory issues come out? Because a lot of people really feel that on top of it, that's what puts them over the edge.
Imagine a wild tiger is running towards you. Now, in that moment, you need all of your senses to be heightened. You need your sight to be heightened so you can see exactly what that tiger is about to do. You need your hearing heightened to see if there are other tigers around and which direction you need to run into. So all your senses become heightened to suddenly deal with that situation. And you know, often people say when they're in the middle of an emergency, suddenly it's as if time stands still. Even that experience of time standing still is when the brain is attempting to, is giving you all your resources. So time is looking as if it's going slower because you are processing so much more information to try and escape the danger. Now, the issue is, if that overstimulation continues, then you start becoming oversensitive to sound, light, touch, chemicals, etc., because that system has not switched off. And that overstimulation is not only from the senses, so there's more signals coming from the senses to the brain. The thalamus then magnifies those signals and passes those signals onto the insula and also the amygdala. The insula, that's another part of the brain, makes a decision on the emotional context of those signals and passes it onto the amygdala, and the amygdala decides whether to then create a stimulation of the nervous system as a result of it. So all these brain structures are processing tons and tons and tons of information, but they are on high alert, and they're taking in too much information, they're processing too much information, and they are oversensitized to that information. And that's why people become sensitive to different things. And that's why across all of these different conditions, you find that people have higher rates of tinnitus, so ringing in the ears,
really?
Sensitivity to loud noises, sensitivities to light, etc., food allergies, chemical allergies. It's just because the brain and the body are just oversensitive, and we need to work on whatever we need to do to retrain the body that it is not in danger. You are not in danger anymore, and if you can get the message to your brain and body that you're not in danger, then it will begin to calm down. So just like those soldiers standing outside the castle, you need to really explain to those soldiers that we are not in danger, the war is over, and you can now relax. And once they relax, then the healing begins.
You know, it reminds me of this sitcom, well, it's not something, a TV show that used to be on many, many years ago, Lost in Space, and there was this robot that used to go around going, danger, danger, danger.
Yes,
and, when I
remember.
When I started learning about it, I was like, that's what it's like. It's like, that little robot just going around telling your brain that you're in danger when really you're not. And it can really, it can be so confusing because I hear so many people that say it's like having arthritis, that the pain is that severe. And it leads to the gastrointestinal problems as well.
Yes. Yes. So in terms of the gastrointestinal problems, the link is once again there with the sympathetic nervous system. When you're running away from that wild tiger, you don't need resources in your gut to be digesting food. You need all your resources to go to your muscles and to your eyes and everything to get you away from the danger. So the gastrointestinal problems are because the digestion system of the body is not at its 100% functioning. So that's the first aspect. Secondly, because of stress, the muscles are all tensed. So the muscles in the gut are tensed up, which contributes to IBS and which can contribute to diarrhea and constipation, and it can yo-yo between the two. And then the other effects are the combination of the different bacteria, of good and bacteria, in the stomach can also, the delicate balance can be disrupted. There are some people who believe there's a leaky gut syndrome, where chemicals can actually leak into the blood through the gut. So there are so many different complications that can cause gut problems
Well, what do you think about the, you know, the brain gut connection is you know, very well known in psychiatry. Do you think that there is an interchange between the brain gut with serotonin as far as the amygdala and these disorders?
I don't think that that would be necessarily a, you know, any kind of cause here. No, I think that different patients will have different levels of issues in the gut. You know, but in terms of serotonin levels, that's not something that I necessarily think is a core part of the theory, no.
And, you know, I think that the way that doctors treat people, my daughter and myself were treated horribly for years.
Sure.
You know, and that's the story you hear from most people, that, you know, there's something wrong with you, that, you know, this is all in your head. And what I loved about the two best doctors, the ones that are still treating my daughter, is they both handled something in the same way, where after they reviewed everything and spoke to us and brought my daughter in, they said, first thing we want to tell you is you are not crazy. You are not mentally ill. You have fibromyalgia, and it is a real illness. And hearing those words is so validating to someone who's suffering with something that makes no sense to them. And your program makes sense to me. So that's why I brought you on here. And, you know, your program you've developed to retrain the amygdala, and this is without medications. So tell us what this program is and how a person can apply it.
Right. Okay, I had a comment on your first statement there around you have fibromyalgia. I think a lot of patients will testify to the fact that it can feel like you're in this altered state, where when you have the condition, you go into this altered state where you feel very wired, you feel very vulnerable, there's almost like a feeling of a dark cloud over you. But then, for whatever reason, suddenly you can have a few hours or a day where you feel absolutely fine, and you've literally, something switched, and you can feel, you know, very normal, and then you can go back into this altered state again. And it can feel like you're going crazy, but actually, all that's happening there is the vicious circle can temporarily slow down, which can bring health back, and then suddenly it speeds up again and causes a lot more of the symptoms. And that can be very puzzling to understand, you know, why do I have good days and bad days and how does that work? So definitely no one's going crazy here. There's a perfectly, you know, logical explanation, I believe, and I believe that more and more doctors and researchers are coming towards this conclusion, that there is a central nervous system hypersensitivity of, you know, different theories as to what the origin of that is, but there is a sensitivity there and there is a vicious loop there. And, you know, so there is a perfectly rational explanation, I believe, for what's going on.
And you know, doctors really need to take care in how they approach this. I mean, I had my daughter's pediatrician who told her, get over it, suck it up. You're 13 years old. You should be out playing and not sitting home complaining.
Yes.
That's damaging
to
a child.
It's very damaging because when someone has this condition, it's very important that you feel safe and secure in your exploration of how you're going to move through it. If someone's telling you that there's something wrong with you and it's your fault, then that can increase the level of vulnerability, it can increase the level of hopelessness, and it can cause very difficult emotions. And I have to help many patients who've got a lot of repressed anger against the people that treated them, which is also still contributing to symptoms. So it's a very important part of
Right.
Yes. Yeah, it's very important.
Well, tell us about your program. We have about 10, 15 minutes left, and I really want you to let everyone know what you have.
Sure. So my program is a whole package of treatment to help someone retrain the amygdala. Now, what do we mean by this? Remember, initially I talked about the inhibitory mechanisms in the brain. This process is designed to strengthen those inhibitory processes so the amygdala is not allowed to run riot and cause all of these symptoms and secondary problems. Now, initially, when someone hears that there's no medication involved, they may think that this is a psychological treatment in some ways. I definitely believe that the illness is a physical illness in the body, and that there is an issue in the brain which is so deeply in the brain that someone doesn't have control of it. You know, the condition is not someone's fault in any way. What my program is designed to do is to strengthen a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. So that's a part of the brain that can send neurons down to the amygdala to to stop the amygdala's reactions. Now, the best way to describe this is learning to drive. Okay. Now, let's say it's the first lesson on the first day of your first driving lesson, and you're sitting in the car. Now, if someone said to you, right, just really think positive and you'll be able to drive a car. You know, you've seen other people drive a car. Just be really positive and I'm sure you'll be able to do it. Now, of course, you're not going to be able to drive a car. So this isn't positive thinking or positive reinforcement or CBT. This is about what you do in that driving lesson, which is that you gradually learn to steer the steering wheel and press the brake, press the accelerator, and do that in a coordinated way. So you teach and train your nervous system to drive a car until hopefully, you know, 6 months, a year later, you can now drive that car automatically without even thinking about it. And you might even be eating a sandwich or, God forbid, be on the mobile phone whilst you're driving. And that's because you've now automated those training processes in the brain. And so it is with my program. And it's not CBT. It's a way of training the prefrontal cortex, so the what we call the intellect part of the brain, to teach it to control the amygdala's reactions. And so when they've done these studies in mice, they found that they can actually detect new neurons being created to control the amygdala's reactions when they've used these kinds of approaches. And that's what this program is designed to do. And in the program, there are lots of new techniques that don't really have a background in normal therapies, but they are derived from things like neuro-linguistic programming, sometimes known as NLP, certain breathing techniques, cognitive restructuring techniques, self-awareness techniques, meditative techniques, lots of different ways that have been put together to create a unique set of tools that can retrain the amygdala. And it took me many years to hone these down to find out what seemed to work for most people most of the time.
You know,
so in a nutshell, that's what we're talking about.
I've done a lot of shows on neuroplasticity because I am really a firm believer in, you know, rewiring the brain, and I've learned that, you know, the brain can be rewired at any age for just about any type of disorder to have some type of benefit. Now, the program that you have needs assistance. So, you know, I know that my concern was that, you know, you're in London, I'm here, but you've found a way to overcome that with coaches and with technology. So why don't you explain that to people and then let them know how they can find you. Oh, and by the way, second to none videos on YouTube. Just look up Ashok Gupta. And unbelievable. You watch these videos, you are really, it's going to be an aha moment for you. So you can go on YouTube and see those. But again, how does this program work, and why do you need a coach to work with you?
Right. So I was finding that people often couldn't afford to come and see me at my clinic in London, or they couldn't travel because obviously they weren't well enough. So I decided to develop a home study course for people to learn the techniques and use them at home by themselves. So I have a home study DVD course, which has 15 hours of DVDs arranged as sessions. So they're like coming to my clinic and having a session with me, but in an interactive DVD format. And together in that, there's also a manual, there's some audio CDs. It's a whole package of treatment that I would have delivered at my clinic. Mm-hmm. Now, for most people, that's enough. They can work with this at home by themselves. But some people definitely do want and need that support. And so we have lots of different ways of supporting people. We have a forum on our website where people can interact with other people who are doing the treatment, and we find that's a great way of not feeling like you're on your own doing this. We also have coaches around the world, and at the moment we are looking to train someone up in the U.S., but most of our practitioners have the ability to do Skype coaching, and Skype coaching works really well. And so wherever someone is in the world, they can have those interactive sessions which help someone with that. And one of the packages, I actually present a three-month webinar program as well. So you have the home study course, and every week for an hour and a half, you have a session with myself in a group where I go through the different treatments and answer people's questions. So people can feel like they're being coached by me personally for 3 months. So there are many different options so that people don't feel they're on their own. And we want to give people as much support as possible as they go through this.
Well, where can they find you?
So the main way of getting information is to come to our website, which is www.guptaprogram.com. And unfortunately, it's the English spelling, so it's Gupta Program with an extra M and an E at the end. So it's guptaprogram.com. And there you can sign up for free videos. So if you sign up with your name and email, then you'll send a week worth of free videos which go through the whole explanation, the hypothesis, and some videos of people who've been through this treatment and their experiences. So you get lots of free information there. And on the website, there is also a link to my explanation of how the condition occurs and what happens, and that's a very detailed explanation as well.
It really is very good.
My medical papers are on there as well. So most of the information you can find on that website.
Well, I thank you so much for joining me. I know you've helped me. I'm going to be speaking to you later. I'm going to be definitely ordering this and finding a good coach to help us. And, you know, would you have any last words for the listeners?
Yes, you know, I believe in doing this ethically. So my aim is to help as many people as possible. And at the moment, we're trying to pursue research. So we're talking to doctors in the U.S. and in Europe to get some larger studies done. I mean, we've done our own small studies, but we want to do some larger studies. And until I get the definitive proof in a large-scale trial that this works for people, I'm offering people their money back if it doesn't work for them. So with the treatment, if people use it, if they notice, you know, no improvement for up to a year, then they can return it and get all their money back, no questions asked. So I think if people are thinking about it, I want them to, you know, watch the videos, find out more, and they've got nothing to lose by putting it into practice.
Absolutely not. And like I said, you know, you're coming at this from a very unique angle for most people that are researching this and doing work on this. So, again, thank you so much for joining me. And, you know, when your studies are done, I hope you'll come back.
Yes, no, I'd love to. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, everyone, I hope that, you know, this interview helped you. I know it helped me. And if you'd like to find out more about me and the Coffee Klatch, you can go to www.thecoffeeklatch.com. Thank you for joining us today.